Hello, happy new year, and welcome back to another section of Gentleman in Moscow by Immortals. We're gonna finish it up in two more sections, I believe. So that's pretty exciting. Hope you enjoyed the new year with friends and family, people you love, and hope you're staying safe and healthy wherever you are. And yeah, subscribe so you catch the last two sections of the book and so that you catch our next read. I suppose I should pick that out. I will pick out a book. And anyway, let's jump on in. We're on page 408. This is called An Announcement. At 6:45 on the 11th of June, Count Alexander Rostov stood in suite 417 dressed in the white jacket of the Boyarsky, ensuring that the place settings were properly arranged and his men properly attired before opening the doors for the 1954 combined dinner of the Presidium and the Council of Ministers. 11 days earlier, as we know, the Count had been excused from this duty rather unceremoniously, but early on the afternoon of the 10th of June, Maître Diduras arrived at the Boyarsky's daily meeting with distressing news. For some time, he said, he had been experiencing a tremor of the hands consistent with the onset of palsy. After a troubled night's sleep, he had awoken to discover that his condition had grown considerably worse. By way of illustration, he held his right hand over the table where it trembled like a leaf. Emil looked on with an expression of shock. What sort of divinity, he seemed to be thinking, would devise a world in which an aging man's malady afflicts the very attribute that has set him apart from his fellow men and elevated him in the eyes of all? What sort of divinity, Emil? The very same who rendered Beethoven deaf and Monet blind. For what the Lord giveth is precisely what he cometh later to taketh away. But if Emil's face expressed an almost sacrilegious indignation at his friend's condition, the bishop's expressed the grimace of the inconvenienced. Noting the manager's annoyance, Andrei sought to set his mind at ease. You needn't worry, Manager Leplevsky. I have already contacted Comrade Prop at the Kremlin and assured him that while I cannot oversee tomorrow night's event, head waiter Rostov will be assuming my responsibilities. Needless to say, the maître d' added, Comrade Prop was greatly relieved by the news. Of course, said the bishop. In reporting that Comrade Prop was greatly relieved to have head waiter Rostov at the helm of this dinner of state, Andrei was not exaggerating. Born 10 years after the revolution, Comrade Prop didn't know that head waiter Rostov was under house arrest at the Metropole. He didn't even know that head waiter Rostov was a former person. What he did know, and from personal experience, was that head waiter Rostov could be counted upon to attend to every detail on the table and respond immediately to the slightest hint of a customer's dissatisfaction. And though Comrade Prop was still relatively inexperienced in the ways of the Kremlin, he was experienced enough to know that any shortcomings in the evening would be laid at his door as surely as if he had set the table, cooked the meal, and poured the wine himself. Comrade Prop personally communicated his relief to the Count during a brief meeting on the morning of the event. At a table for two in the Boyarsky, the young liaison reviewed with the Count, quite unnecessarily, all the details of the evening. The timing, the doors were to be opened promptly at 9 o'clock, the layout of the tables, a long U with 20 seats on either side and 6 at the head, the menu, Shevsikovsky's interpretation of a traditional Russian feast, the wine, a Ukrainian white, and the necessity of dousing the candles at exactly 10:59. Then, perhaps, to emphasize the evening's importance, Comrade Prop gave the Count a glimpse of the guest list. While it's true that the Count generally hadn't concerned himself with the inner workings of the Kremlin, that does not just suggest that he was unfamiliar with the names on that piece of paper, for he had served them all. Certainly, he had served them at formal functions in the red and yellow rooms, but he had also served them at more intimate and less guarded tables of the Boyarsky, where they had dined with wives or mistresses, friends or enemies, patrons or protégés. He knew the boorish from the abrupt and the bitter from the boastful. He had seen all of them sober and most of them drunk. All will be seen to, said the Count, as the young apparatchik stood to go. But Comrade Prop paused.
Yes, Head Waiter Rostov, have I forgotten something? You haven't given me the seating arrangement. Ah, not to worry. Tonight there is to be no seating arrangement. Then rest assured, the Count replied with a smile. The evening is bound to be a success. Why was the Count so pleased that this dinner of state would have no seating arrangement? For 1,000 years, civilizations the world over have recognized the head of the table as a privileged spot. Upon seeing a formally set table, one knows instinctively that the seat at the head is more desirable than those along the sides, because it inevitably confers upon its occupant an appearance of power, importance, and legitimacy. By extension, one also knows that the farther one sits from the head, the less powerful, important, and legitimate one is likely to be perceived. So, to invite 46 leaders of a political party to dine around the periphery of an extended U without a seating arrangement was to risk a certain amount of disorder. Thomas Hobbes, no doubt, would have likened the situation to man in a state of nature, and would have counseled one to expect a scuffle. Born with similar faculties and driven by similar desires, the 46 men in attendance had equal right to any seat at the table. As such, what was most likely to ensue was a scrum for the head, animated by accusations, recriminations, fisticuffs, and possibly gunfire. John Locke, on the other hand, would argue that once the dining room's doors were opened, after a brief moment of confusion, the better natures of the 46 men would prevail, and their predisposition to reason would lead them to a fair and orderly process of seat-taking. Thus, in all likelihood, the attendees would draw lots to decide their placement, or simply reconfigure the table into a circle, just as King Arthur had to ensure the equity of his knights. Chiming in from the mid-18th century, Jean-Jacques Rousseau would inform Monsieur Locke and Hobbes that the 46 guests, freed and long last from the tyranny of social conventions, would shove the tables aside, gather the fruits of the earth in hand, and share them freely in a state of natural bliss. But the Communist Party was not a state of nature. Quite to the contrary, it was one of the most intricate and purposeful constructions ever manufactured by man. In essence, the hierarchy of all hierarchies. So when the guests arrived, the Count was fairly certain that there would be no raising of fists, drawing of lots, or free-spirited sharing of fruits. Rather, with only the slightest jostling and jockeying, each of the 46 attendees would find their proper place at the table, and this spontaneous arrangement would tell the studious observer all he needed to know about the governance of Russia for the next 20 years. At the Count's signal, the doors to Suite 417 were opened at precisely 9 p.m. By 9:15, 46 men of various rank and seniority were taking the seats appropriate to their station. Without a word of orchestration, the head of the table was left to Bulganin, Khrushchev, Malenkov, Mikoyan, Molotov, and Voroshilov, the six most eminent members of the party, with the two center seats reserved for Premier Malenkov and General Secretary Khrushchev. Footnote. The studious reader will recall upon Stalin's death, there were 8 men of eminence at the pinnacle of the party. Where were the other two at the time of this dinner? Lazar Kaganovich, a fine old Stalinist in the iron-fisted mold, had been sent on an administrative mission to Ukraine. Within a few years, he would be presiding over a potassium factory 1,000 miles from Moscow. But at least he fared better than Lavrenti Beria, the former head of the secret police, who many Western observers thought well-positioned to inherit the throne when Stalin died, instead was decorated by the party with a pistol shot to the head. And then there were 6. I'm going to close my window. The interruption. Back to the text, middle of page 411. In fact, as if to make the point, when Khrushchev entered the room, he didn't even walk in the direction of the table's head. Rather, he exchanged a few remarks with Vyacheslav Mileshev, a rather mundane minister of medium machine building, who was sitting near the table's end. Only when everyone else was comfortable did the former mayor of Moscow pat Mileshev on the shoulder and casually work his way to the seat beside Malenkov, the last empty chair in the room. Over the next 2 hours, the men in attendance ate heartily, drank freely, and gave toasts that ranged in tone from the high-minded to the humorous, but always in the most patriotic of spirits. And in between toasts, as the count presented courses, refilled glasses, replaced utensils, whisked away plates, and swept crumbs from the linens, the attendees made asides to the men on their left, conferred with the men on their right, or muttered to themselves under the hum of the festivities. Upon reading this, you may be tempted to ask a little sardonically whether Count Rostov, this self-proclaimed man of propriety, allowed himself to overhear any of the private exchanges around the table. But your question, and your cynicism, would be entirely misplaced. For as with the best manservants, it is the business of capable waiters to overhear. Consider the example of Grand Duke Demidov's butler. In his day, Kemp could stand for hours at the edge of the library, silent and stiff as a statue. But should one of the Grand Duke's guests even mention that he was thirsty, Kemp was there with an offer of a drink. Should someone complain quietly of a chill, Kemp was at the fireside stirring the coals. And when the Grand Duke observed to a friend that while the Countess Shermatova was a delight, her son was unreliable, Kemp would know without being told that should either of the Shermatovas appear at the door unannounced, the Grand Duke was available to the one and indisposed to the other. So did the Count overhear any of the private exchanges of the attendees? Did he hear any of the sly observations, pointed asides, or dismissive remarks uttered sotto voce? He heard every single word. Every man has his own personality at the table, and one needn't have waited upon the members of the Communist Party for 28 years to know that while Comrade Malenkov only toasted upon occasion, and then with a glass of white wine, Comrade Khrushchev would give four toasts in an evening and always with vodka. Thus, it did not escape the Count's notice that during the course of the meal, the former mayor of Moscow never once rose to his feet, but at 10 minutes to 11, when the meal was nearly over, and General Secretary rapped on the desk with the blade of his knife. "Gentlemen," he began, "the Metropole is no stranger to historic events. In fact, in 1918, Comrade Sverdlov locked the members of the Constitutional Drafting Committee in the suite two floors below us, informing them that they would not be let out until their work was done." Laughter and applause. "To Sverdlov," someone called out, and as Khrushchev emptied his glass with a self-assured grin, all around the table followed suit. "Tonight," continued Khrushchev, "we have the honor of witnessing another historic event at the Metropole. If you will join me at the windows, comrades, I believe that Minister Mileshev has an announcement." With expressions ranging from curious to bemused, the 44 other attendees pushed back their chairs and approached the great windows overlooking Theater Square, where Mileshev was already standing. "Thank you, General Secretary," Mileshev said with a bow toward Khrushchev, followed by a weighty pause. "Comrades, as most of you know, 3.5 years ago, we began construction of our new power plant in the city of Obninsk. I am proud to announce that on Monday afternoon, the Obninsk facility became fully operational 6 months ahead of schedule." Appropriate commendations and the nodding of heads. "Furthermore," Mileshev continued, "at exactly 11 o'clock tonight, in less than 2 minutes, the plant will begin providing power to half the city of Moscow." With that, Mileshev turned and faced the windows as the Count and Martin quietly snuffed the candles on the table. Outside, the lights of Moscow glimmered in the same old fashion, such that as the seconds ticked by, the men in the room began shifting on their feet and exchanging remarks. But suddenly, in far northwestern corner of the city, the lights in a neighborhood 10 blocks square went out all at once, A moment later, the lights went out in the adjacent quarter. Then the darkness began moving across the city like a shadow across a plain, growing closer and closer until, at roughly 11:02, the eternally lit windows of the Kremlin went black, followed a few seconds later by those of the Metropole Hotel. In the darkness, the mutterings of a moment before rose in volume and shifted in tone, expressing some combination of surprise and consternation. But the attentive observer could see from Malyshev's silhouette that when the darkness fell, he neither spoke nor moved. He continued to stare out the window. Suddenly, in the far northwest corner of the capital, the lights of those initially darkened blocks flickered back on. Now it was luminescence that was moving across the city, growing closer and closer until the windows of the Kremlin flashed on, followed by the chandelier overhead, and the combined dinner of the Presidium and the Council of Ministers erupted into justified applause. For in fact, the lights of the city seemed to burn brighter with the electricity from the first nuclear power plant in the world. Without a doubt, the finale to this dinner of state was as fine a piece of political theater as Moscow had ever seen. But when the lights went out, were any of the city citizens inconvenienced? Luckily, in 1954, Moscow was not the world capital of electrical appliances, but in the brief course of the outage, at least 300,000 clocks stopped, 40,000 radios were silent, and 5,000 televisions went black. Dogs howled and cats meowed, standing lamps were toppled, children cried, parents banged their shins into coffee tables, and more than a few drivers, looking up from their windshields at the suddenly darkened buildings, ran into the fenders of the automobiles in front of them. And that little gray building on the corner of Sierzynski Street, the little gray fellow who was charged with taking down the eavesdropping of waitresses, kept right on typing. For like any good bureaucrat, he knew how to type with his eyes closed. Although, when a few moments after the lights went out, someone stumbled in the hallway and our startled typist looked up. His fingers inevitably shifted one column of keys to the right, such that the second half of his report was either unintelligible or in code, depending on your point of view. Meanwhile, at the Mali Theater, where Anna Urbanova, in a wig tinged with gray, was appearing as Irina Arkadina in Chekhov's The Seagull, the audience let out muted exclamations of concern. Though Anna and her fellow actors were well practiced at leaving the stage in the dark, they made no move to do so. For having been trained in the methods of Stanislavski, they immediately began acting exactly as their characters would have acted had they suddenly found themselves in a blackout. Arkadina, alarmed. The lights have gone out. Trigorin, stay where you are, my dear. I'll look for a candle. The sound of cautious movement as Trigorin exits right, followed by a moment of silence. Arkadina, oh, Konstantin, I'm frightened. Konstantin, it is only darkness, mother, from that which we have come and to which we shall return. Arkadina, as if she hasn't listened to her son, do you think the lights have gone out all over Russia? Konstantin, no, mother, they have gone out all over the world. And at the Metropole, two waiters in the piazza carrying drinks to their tables collided. Four customers in the Shilopin spilled their drinks, and one was pinched, trapped in the elevator between the second and third floors. The American, Pudgy Webster, shared chocolate bars and cigarettes with his fellow passengers, while alone in his office, the hotel's manager vowed to get to the bottom of this. But in the dining room of the Boyarsky, where for almost 50 years the ambiance had been defined by candlelight, the customers were served without interruption. This chapter is called Anecdotes. On the night of the 16th of June, besides Sophia's empty suitcase and knapsack, the Count laid out all the various items that he had collected on her behalf. The night before, when she'd returned from rehearsal, he had sat her down and explained exactly what it was that she must do. "Why have you waited until now to speak of this?" she asked, on the verge of tears. "I was afraid if I told you earlier, you would object." "But I do object." "I know," he said, taking her hands, "but oftentimes, Sophia, our best course of action appears objectionable at the first step. In fact, it almost always does. What followed was a debate between father and daughter on the whys and wherefores, a contrasting of perspectives, a comparison of time, horizons, and heartfelt expressions of conflicting hopes. But in the end, the Count asked Sophia that she trust him, and this proved to be a request that she did not know how to refuse. So, after a moment of shared silence, with the courage that she had shown since the first day they met, Sophia listened attentively as the Count went over every detail, step by step. Tonight, as he finished laying out the items, the Count reviewed the same details for himself, to ensure that nothing had been forgotten or overlooked, and he was feeling, at last, that everything was in order, when the door flung open. "They have changed the venue," Sophia exclaimed out of breath. Father and daughter traded anxious looks. "To what?" About to answer, Sophia stopped and closed her eyes, then opened them with a suggestion of distress. "I can't remember." "It's all right," assured the Count, knowing full well that distress was no friend to recollection. "What did the director say exactly? Do you remember anything about the new location? Any aspect of its neighborhood or name?" Sophia closed her eyes again. "It was a hall, I think. A salle. The salle pleuel?" "That's it." The Count breathed a sigh of relief. "We didn't worry. I know the spot well. A historic venue with fine acoustics, which also happens to be in the 8th. So, as Sophia packed her bags, the Count went down to the basement. Having found the second Paris Baedeker, he tore out the map, climbed the stairs, sat at the Grand Duke's desk, and drew a new red line. Then, when all the straps were tightened and latches snapped, with a touch of ceremony, the Count ushered Sophia through the closet door into the study, much as he had 16 years before. And just as on that occasion, Sophia said, "Ooh." For since she had set out earlier that afternoon to attend her last rehearsal, their secret study had been transformed. On the bookcase, a candelabra burned brightly. The two high-backed chairs had been set at either end of the Count's oriental coffee table, which in turn had been draped with linen, decorated with a small arrangement of flowers, and set with the hotel's finest silver. "Your table awaits," said the Count with a smile, pulling out Sophia's chair. "Akrushka?" she asked, as she put her napkin in her lap. "Absolutely," said the Count, taking his seat. "Before one travels abroad, it is best to have a simple, heartwarming soup from home, so that one can recall it fondly, should one ever happen to feel a little low." "I shall be sure to do so," said Sophia with a smile, "the minute I become homesick." As they were finishing their soup, Sophia noticed that tucked beside the arrangement of flowers was a little silver lady in an 18th-century dress. "What is that?" she asked. "Why don't you see for yourself?" Sophia picked up the little lady, and hearing the hint of a jangle, waggled it back and forth. At the sound of the resulting chime, the door to the study swung open, and in came Andrew, pushing a Regency cart topped with a silver dome. "Bonsoir, monsieur. Bonsoir, mademoiselle." What did I say? It's bonsoir. Bonsoir. Sophia laughed. "I trust you enjoy the soup," he said. "It was delicious." "Très bien." Andrew whisked the bowls from the table and stowed them on the bottom shelf of his cart, as the Count and Sophia looked to the silver dome with anticipation. But when Andrew stood back up, instead of revealing what Chef Sukovsky had in store for them, he produced a pad. "Before I serve the next course," he explained, "I will need you to confirm your satisfaction with the soup. Please sign here, and here, and here." The look of shock on the Count's face prompted a burst of laughter from both Andrew and Sophia. Then, with a flourish, the maitre d' raised the dome and presented Emile's newest specialty, goose a la Sophia, in which he explained, "The goose is hoisted in a dumbwaiter, chased down a hall, and thrown from a window before being roasted." Andrew carved the bird, served the vegetables, and poured the Chateau Margaux, all in a single motion of the hands. Then he wished the diners bon appétit as he backed out the door. While the two enjoyed Emile's latest creation, the Count recalled for Sophia in some detail the commotion he had found on the fourth floor that morning in 1946, including the army issue briefs that Richard Vanderweil had saluted. And this somehow led to a retelling of the time that Anna Urbanova threw all her clothes out of the window, only to gather them back up in the middle of the night. Which is to say, they share those humorous little stories of which family lore is made. Perhaps some will find this surprising, having supposed that the Count would reserve this particular dinner for an offering of polonial advice or expressions of heartache, but the Count had quite intentionally chosen to see to all of that the night before, after their discussion of what was to be done. Showing a sense of personal restraint that was almost out of character, the Count had restricted himself to two succinct pieces of parental advice. The first was that if one did not master one's circumstances, one was bound to be mastered by them. And the second was Montaigne's maxim that the surest sign of wisdom is constant cheerfulness. But when it came back to expressing admissions of heartache, the Count had not held back. He told her exactly how sad he would be in her absence, and yet how joyful he would feel at the slightest thought of her grand adventure. Why was the Count so careful to ensure that all of this was covered on the night before Sophia's journey? Because, well, he knew that when one is traveling abroad for the first time, one does not wish to look back on laborsome instructions, weighty advice, or tearful sentiments. Like the memory of the simple soup, when one is homesick, what one will find most comforting to recall are those light-hearted little stories that have been told a thousand times before. That said, when their plates were finally empty, the Count attempted to broach a new subject that had clearly weighed on his mind. "I was thinking," he began rather haltingly, "or rather it occurred to me that you might like, or at some point perhaps..." Amused to see her father so uncharacteristically flummoxed, Sophia laughed. "What is it, Papa? What might I like?" Reaching into his jacket, the Count sheepishly removed the photograph that Mishka had tucked into the pages of his project. "I know how you treasure the photograph of your parents, so I thought you might like a picture of me as well." Blushing for the first time in over 40 years, he handed her the picture, adding, "It's the only one I have." Genuinely moved, Sophia accepted the photograph with every intention of expressing her deepest gratitude, but getting a look at the picture, she clapped a hand over her mouth and began to laugh. "Your mustaches," she blurted.
I know, he said. "Although, believe it or not, at one time, they were the envy of the jockey club."
Sophia laughed aloud again. "All right," said the Count, holding out his hand. "If you don't want it, I understand." But she gripped the picture to her chest. "I wouldn't part with it for the world." Smiling, she took another peek at his mustaches, then looked up at her father in wonder. "Whatever happened to them?" "What happened to them indeed?" Taking a considerable drink of his wine, the Count told Sophia of the afternoon in 1922 when one of his mustaches had been clipped so unceremoniously by a heavyset fellow in the hotel's barbershop. "What a brute!" "Yes," agreed the Count, "and a glimpse of things to come. But, in a way, I have that fellow to thank for my life with you."
"How do you mean?"
The Count explained how a few days after the incident in the barbershop, her mother had popped up at his table in the piazza to ask, in essence, the very same question that Sophia had just asked. Where did they go? And with that simple inquiry, their friendship had commenced. Now it was Sophia who took a drink from her wine. "Do you ever regret coming back to Russia?" she asked after a moment. "I mean, after the revolution." The Count studied his daughter. If when Sophia had stepped out of Anna's room in her blue dress, the Count had felt she was crossing the threshold into adulthood, then here was the perfect confirmation. For in both tone and intent, when Sophia posed this question, she did not do so as a child asks a parent, but as one adult asks another about the choices he has made. So the Count gave the question its due consideration. Then he told her the truth. "Looking back, it seems to me that there are people who play an essential role at every turn. And I don't just mean the Napoleons who influence the course of history. I mean men and women who routinely appear at the critical junctures in the progress of art or commerce or the evolution of ideas. as if life itself has summoned them once again to help fulfill its purpose. Well, since the day I was born, Sophia, there was only one time when life needed me to be in a particular place at a particular time. And that was when your mother brought you to the lobby of the Metropole, and I would not accept the czarship of all the Russias in exchange for being in this hotel at that hour. Sophia rose from the table to give her father a kiss on the cheek. Then, returning to her chair, she leaned back, squinted, and said,
"Famous threesomes."
"Ha ha!" exclaimed the Count. Thus, as the candles were consumed by their flames and the bottle of Margaux was drunk to its lees, reference was made to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, Purgatory, Heaven, and Hell, the three rings of Moscow, the three Magi, the three Fates, the three Musketeers, the Grey Ladies from Macbeth, the Riddle of the Sphinx, the heads of Cerberus, the Pythagorean Theorem, Forks, Spoons, and Knives, Reading, Writing, and Arithmetic, Faith, Hope, and Love, with the greatest of these being Love. Past, present, future. Beginning, middle, end. Morning, noon, and night. The sun, the moon, the stars. And with this particular category, perhaps the game could have gone on all night long, but for the fact that the Count tipped over his own king with a bow of the head when Sophia said, "Andrei, Emil, and Alexander." At 10 o'clock, when the Count and Sophia snuffed the candles and returned to their bedroom, there was a delicate knock on the door. The two looked at each other with the wistful smiles of those who know the hour has come. "Enter," said the Count. It was Marina in her hat and coat. "I'm sorry if I'm late." "No, no, you're right on time." As Sophia took a jacket from the closet, the Count picked up her suitcase and knapsack from the bed. Then the three of them headed down the belfry to the fifth floor, where they exited, crossed the hallway, and continued their descent on the main staircase. Earlier that day, Sophia had already said her goodbyes to Arkady and Vasily. Nonetheless, they came out from behind their desks to see her off, and they were joined a moment later by Andrei in his tuxedo and Emil in his apron. Even Audrius appeared from behind the bar of the Shilopin, leaving his customers unattended for a change. This little assembly gathered around Sophia in a circle of well-wishing, while feeling that touch of envy which is perfectly acceptable among family and friends, from one generation to the next. "You'll be the belle of Paris," one of them said. "We can't wait to hear all about it. Someone get her suitcase for her. Yes, her train is leaving within the hour." When Marina went outside to call for a taxi, as if by prior agreement, Arkady, Vasily, Audrius, Andrei, and Emil all fell a few paces back, so that the Count and Sophia could have a few final words alone. Then father and daughter embraced, and Sophia, despite being uncertain of a claim, passed through the endlessly spinning doors of the Metropole Hotel. Returning to the sixth floor, the Count spent a moment looking around his bedroom from corner to corner, finding that it already seemed unnaturally quiet. "So, this is an empty nest," he thought. "What a sad state of affairs." Pouring himself a glass of brandy and taking a good swallow, he sat down at the Grand Duke's desk and wrote 5 letters on the hotel's stationery. When he was done, the Count put the letters in the drawer. He brushed his teeth, he donned his pajamas, and then, despite the fact that Sophia was gone, he slept on the mattress under the bed springs. Page 423. My head's cut off. That's my hand. Say hello to it. Okay. 423. An association. With the coming of the Second World War, many eyes in imprisoned Europe turned hopefully or desperately toward the freedom of the Americas. Lisbon became the great embarkment point. But not everybody could get to Lisbon directly, and so a tortuous roundabout refugee trail sprang up. Paris to Marseille, across the Mediterranean to Oran, then by train or auto or foot across the rim of Africa to Casablanca in French Morocco. Here, the fortunate ones, through money or influence or luck, might obtain exit visas and scurry to Lisbon, and from Lisbon to the New World. But others wait in Casablanca, and wait, and wait, and wait. "I've got to hand it to you, Alexander," whispered Ossip. "This was an excellent choice. I'd quite forgotten how exciting it is."
"Shh," said the Count. "It's beginning."
Having initiated their studies in 1930, with monthly meetings over the years, the Count and Ossip had met with less frequency. In the way of these things, the two men began meeting quarterly, then semi-annually, then suddenly, they weren't meeting at all. Why, you might ask? But does there need to be a reason? Do you still dine with any of the friends with whom you dined 20 years ago? Suffice it to say that the two shared a fondness for each other, and despite their best intentions, life intervened. So, when Ossip happened to visit the Boyarsky with a colleague one night in early June, as he was leaving the restaurant, he approached the Count in order to remark that it had been too long.
"Yes, it has," agreed the Count. "We should get together for a film."
"The sooner the better," said Ossip with a smile. And the two men might have left it at that, but as Ossip turned to join his colleague at the door, the Count was struck by a notion. "What is an intention when compared to a plan?" he said, catching Ossip by the sleeve. "If the sooner the better, then why not next week?" Turning back, Ossip considered the Count for a moment. "You know, you're absolutely right, Alexander. How about the 19th?
"The 19th would be perfect.
What shall we watch?" Without hesitation, the Count said, "Casablanca."
"Casablanca," Ossip groaned.
"Isn't Humphrey Bogart your favorite?"
"Of course he is, but Casablanca isn't a Humphrey Bogart movie. It's just a love story in which he happens to appear."
"On the contrary, I suggest to you that Casablanca is the Humphrey Bogart movie."
"You just think that because he wears a white dinner jacket for half the film."
"That's preposterous," the Count replied a little stiffly.
"Maybe it's a little preposterous," conceded Ossip, "but I don't want to watch Casablanca."
No one to be outmaneuvered by another man's childishness, the Count pouted.
"All right," Ossip sighed, "but if you get to pick the film, I get to pick the food."
As it turned out, once the film was flickering, Ossip was rapt. After all, there was the murder of the two German couriers in the desert, then the rounding up of suspects in the marketplace, the shooting of a fugitive, the pickpocketing of a Brit, the arrival by plane of the Gestapo, music and gambling at Rick's Cafe in Rick's Cafe Américain, as well as the stashing of two letters of transit in a piano. And that was in the first 10 minutes. In minute 20, when Captain Renault instructed his officer to take Ugarte quietly, and the officer saluted, Ossip saluted too. When Ugarte cashed in his winnings, Ossip cashed in his. And when Ugarte dashed between the guards, slammed the door, drew his pistol, and fired four shots, Ossip dashed, slammed, drew, and fired.
Stage direction. With nowhere to hide, Ugarte runs madly down the hall. Seeing Rick appear from the opposite direction, he grabs him. Ugarte.
"Rick! Rick! Help me!"
Rick. "Don't be a fool. You can't get away."
Ugarte. "Rick, hide me. Do something. You must help me. Rick, do something. Rick, Rick!"
Rick stands impassively as guards and gendarmes drag Ugarte off.
Customer. "When they come to get me, Rick, I hope you'll be more of a help."
Rick.
"I stick my neck out for nobody."
Moving casually across the tables and disconcerted customers, some of whom are on the point of leaving, Rick speaks to the room in a calm voice.
Rick.
"I'm sorry there was a disturbance, folks, but it's all over now. Everything's all right. Just sit down and have a good time. Enjoy yourself."
"All right, Sam."
Sam and his orchestra began to play, restoring something of a carefree mood to the saloon. Ossip leaned toward the Count.
"You may have been right, Alexander. This may be Bogart at his best. Do you see the indifference he expressed as Ugarte was practically pulled from his lapels? And when that superior American makes his smug remark, Bogart doesn't even deign to look at him when he replies.
Then, after instructing the piano player to play, he goes about his business as if nothing had happened. Listening to Osip with a frown, the Count suddenly stood and switched off the projector. Are we going to watch the movie or talk about it? Taken aback, Osip assured his friend, we're going to watch.
Until the end?
Until the credits roll. Thus, the Count switched the projector back on while Osip paid his utmost attention to the screen. If the truth be told, having made such a fuss about attentiveness, the Count could not pay his utmost attention to the progress of the movie. Yes, he was watching closely enough when at minute 38, Sam finds Rick drinking whiskey alone in the saloon. But when the smoke from Rick's cigarette doll dissolves into a montage of his days in Paris with Ilsa, the Count's thoughts dissolved into a Parisian montage of his own. Unlike Rick's, however, the Count's montage did not draw on his memories. It drew instead on his imaginings. It began with Sophia disembarking in the Gare du Nord as steam from the locomotive billowed across the platform. Moments later, she was outside the station with her bags in hand, preparing to board the bus with her fellow musicians. Then she was looking out the window at the sights of the city as they drove to the hotel where the young musicians would remain until their concert. Under the watchful gaze of two members of the conservatory staff, two representatives from Vox, a cultural attaché, and three chaperones in the employ of the KGB. When the movie returned from Paris to Casablanca, so did the Count. Setting aside thoughts of his daughter, he followed the action while noting through the corner of his eye Osip's complete submission to the plights of the principals. But the Count took particular pleasure in his friend's engagement during the final minutes of the film. For with the plane to Lisbon in the air and Major Strasser dead on the ground, when Captain Renault frowned at the bottle of Vichy water, dropped it in a wastebasket and kicked it across the floor, Osip Glebnikov, the former Red Army colonel and high official of the party, who was sitting on the edge of his seat, poured, frowned, dropped, and kicked. Okay. We'll get through this chapter and then we'll stop for now. Antagonists at Arms and an Absolution. Good evening and welcome to the Boyarsky, began the Count in Russian as the middle-aged couple with blonde hair and blue eyes looked up from their menus. Do you speak English? The husband asked in English, though with a decidedly Scandinavian cadence. Good evening and welcome to the Boyarsky, the Count translated accordingly. My name is Alexander and I will be your waiter tonight. But before describing our specials, may I offer you an aperitif? I think we are ready to order, said the husband. We have just arrived in the hotel after a long day of travel, explained the wife with a weary smile. The Count hesitated. And where, if I may ask, have you been traveling from?
Helsinki, said the husband with a hint of impatience.
Well then,
Tervetuloa, Moskova, said the Count.
Kietos, replied the wife with a smile. Given your long journey, I will see to it that you are served a delightful meal without delay. But before I take your order, would you be so kind as to give me your room number? From the beginning, the Count had determined that he would need to filch a few things from a Norwegian, a Dane, a Swede, or a Finn. On the face of it, the task should not have posed a significant challenge, as Scandinavian visitors were reasonably common at the Metropole. The problem was that the visitor in question was sure to notify the hotel's manager as soon as he discovered that his pocket had been picked, which in turn might lead to the notification of authorities, the official interviewing of the hotel staff, perhaps even the searching of rooms and the posting of guards at railway stations. So the pocket picking would have to take place at the very last minute. In the meantime, the Count could only cross his fingers that a Scandinavian man would be residing in the hotel at the critical juncture. With grim attention, he had watched as a salesman from Stockholm checked out of the hotel on the 13th of June. Then on the 17th, a journalist from Oslo had been recalled by his paper. In no small terms, the Count berated himself for not acting sooner, when lo and behold, with only 24 hours to spare, a pair of beleaguered Finns came into the Boyarsky and sat right at his table. But there remained one small complication. The primary item that the Count hoped to secure was the gentleman's passport. And as most foreigners in Russia carried their passports about on their person, the Count would not be able to pay a visit to the Finn's suite on the following morning when they were touring about the city. He would need to visit the suite tonight, while they were in it. As much as we hate to admit the fact, fate does not take sides. It is fair-minded and generally prefers to maintain some balance between the likelihood of success and failure in all our endeavors. Thus, having put the Count in the challenging position of having to lift a passport at the very last minute, fate offered the Count a small consolation. For at 9:30, when he asked the Finns if they would like to see the dessert cart, they declined on the grounds that they were exhausted and ready for bed. Shortly after midnight, when the Boyarsky was closed and the Count had bid goodnight to Andrei and Emil, he climbed the stairs to the third floor, went halfway down the hall, took off his shoes, and then, by means of Nina's key, slipped into suite 322 in his stocking feet. Many years before, under a spell cast by a certain actress, the Count had dwelt for a time among the ranks of the invisible. So, as he tiptoed into the Finn's bedroom, he called upon Venus to veil him in a mist, just as she had for her son Aeneas, when he wandered the streets of Carthage, so that his footfalls would be silent, his heart beat still, and his presence in the room no more notable than a breath of air. As it was late in June, the Finns had drawn their curtains to block out the glow of the white night, but a sliver of light remained where the two drapes met. By this narrow illumination, the Count approached the foot of the bed and took in the sleeping forms of the travelers. Thanks be to God, they were about 40 years old. 15 years younger, they would not have been asleep. Having stumbled back from a late dinner in the Arbat, at which they had ordered two bottles of wine, they would now be in each other's arms. 15 years older, they would be tossing and turning, getting up twice a night to visit the loo. But at 40, they had enough appetite to eat well, enough temperance to drink in moderation, and enough wisdom to celebrate the absence of their children by getting a good night's sleep. Within a matter of minutes, the Count had secured the gentleman's passport and 150 Finnish marks from the bureau, tiptoed through the sitting room, and slipped back into the hallway, which was empty. In fact, it was so empty that even his shoes weren't in it. "Confound it," said the Count to himself. "They must have been picked up by the night service for shining." After issuing a litany of self-recriminations, the Count took comfort that, in all likelihood, on the following morning, his shoes would simply be returned by the Finns to the main desk, where they would be cast into the hotel's collection of unidentifiable misplaced possessions. As he climbed the stairs of the belfry, he took additional comfort that all else had gone according to plan. "By this time, tomorrow night," he was thinking as he opened his bedroom door, only to discover the bishop sitting at the Grand Duke's desk. Naturally enough, the Count's first instinct at the sight was a feeling of indignation. Not only had this account of discrepancies, this stripper of wine labels entered the Count's quarters without invitation. He had actually rested his elbows on that dimpled surface where once had been written persuasive arguments to statesmen and exquisite counsel to friends. The Count was just opening his mouth to demand an explanation when he saw that the drawer had been opened and that a sheet of paper was in the bishop's hand. The letters, the Count realized with a feeling of dread. Oh, if it had only been the letters. Carefully written expressions of fondness and fellowship may not have been common between colleagues, but they were hardly suspicious in and of themselves. A man has every right, and some responsibility, to communicate his good feelings to his friends. But it was not one of the recently written letters that the bishop was holding. It was the first of the Baedeker maps, the one on which the Count had drawn the bright red line connecting the Palais Garnier to the American embassy by way of the Avenue Georges V. Then again, perhaps whether it was a letter or a map mattered not, for when the bishop had turned at the sound of the door, he had witnessed the transition in the Count's expression from indignation to horror, a transition that confirmed a state of guilt even before an accusation had been made. "Hedwig Rostov," said the bishop, as if to surprised to see the count in his own room. You are truly a man of many interests. Wine, cuisine, the streets of Paris. Yes, said the count, while attempting to compose himself. I have been reading a bit of Proust lately, and thus have been reacquainting myself with the arrangement of the city's arrondissements. Of course, said the bishop. Cruelty knows that it has no need of histrionics. It can be as calm and quiet as it likes. It can sigh or lightly shake its head in disbelief, or offer a sympathetic apology for whatever it must do. It can move slowly, methodically, inevitably. Thus, the bishop, having gently laid the map on the dimpled surface of the Grand Duke's desk, now rose from the chair, walked across the room, and slipped past the count without a word. What went through the mind of the bishop as he descended the five flights from the attic to the ground floor? What emotion did he feel? Perhaps it was gloating. Having felt belittled by the count for over 30 years, perhaps he now felt the pleasure of finally putting this pretentious polymath in his place. Or perhaps it was righteousness. Perhaps Comrade Leplevsky was so dedicated to the brotherhood of the proletariat from which he'd sprung, that the persistence of this former person in the new Russia galled his sense of justice. Or maybe it was simply the cold satisfaction of the envious. For those who had difficulty in school or at making friends when they were young will forever recognize with a bitter glance those for whom life has seemed to come easy. Gloating, righteousness, satisfaction, who can say? But the emotion the bishop felt upon opening the door to his office was almost certainly that of shock, for the adversary that he had left in the attic just minutes before was now sitting behind the manager's desk with a pistol in his hand. How was this possible? When the bishop left the count's bedroom, the count was frozen in place by a torrent of emotions, by feelings of fury, incredulity, self-incrimination, and fear. Rather than burn the map, like a fool, he had slipped it in his drawer. 6 months of the most careful planning and painstaking execution overturned by a single misstep. And what was worse, he had put Sophia at risk. What price was she to pay for his carelessness? But if the count was frozen in place, he was frozen for all of 5 seconds, for these perfectly understandable sentiments, which threatened to drain the blood from his heart, were swept aside by resolve. Turning on his heels, the count went to the head of the belfry and listened until the bishop had descended the first 2 flights of stairs. Still in his stocking feet, the count began to follow in the bishop's footsteps, but when he got to the 5th floor, he exited the belfry, sped down the hallway, and ran to the main staircase, just as Sophia had at the age of 13. And, as if he were still enshrouded in a mist, when the count alit from the stairs, he ran down the hall and entered the executive offices without being seen by a soul. But upon reaching the bishop's door, he discovered it was locked. Even as he was taking the Lord's name in vain, the count slapped his hands against his vest with relief, for he still had Nina's passkey in his pocket. Letting himself in, the count relocked the door and crossed to the wall where the filing cabinets had taken the place of Mr. Halecki's chaise. Counting from the portrait of Karl Marx, the count placed his hand in the center of the 2nd panel to the right, gave a push, and popped it open. Taking the inlaid box from its chamber, the count set it on the desk and opened the lid. Simply marvelous, he said. Then, sitting in the manager's chair, the count removed the 2 pistols, loaded them, and waited. He guessed that he had only a matter of seconds before the door would open, but he used them as best he could to moderate his breathing, lower his heart rate, and calm his nerves, such that by the time the bishop's key turned in the lock, he was as cold as a killer. So unanticipated was the count's presence behind the desk that the bishop had swung the door closed before even noticing that he was there. But if every man has his strengths, one of the bishop's was that he was never more than a step away from a petty protocol and an inherent sense of superiority. "Head waiter Rostov," he said almost peevishly, "you have no business being in this office. I insist that you leave immediately." The count raised one of the pistols. "Sit down." "How dare you?" "Sit down," the count repeated more slowly. The bishop would be the first to admit that he had no experience with firearms. In fact, he could barely distinguish a revolver and a semi-automatic. But any fool could see that what the Count was holding was an antique, a museum piece, a curiosity. "You leave me no choice but to alert the authorities," he said. Then, stepping forward, he took up the receiver from one of his two telephones. The Count shifted his aim from the bishop to the portrait of Stalin and shot the former premier between the eyes. Shocked by either the sound or the sacrilege, the bishop jumped back, dropping the receiver with a clatter. The Count raised the second pistol and leveled it at the bishop's chest. "Sit down," he said again. This time, the bishop obliged. With the second gun still trained on the bishop's chest, the Count now stood. He replaced the telephone receiver in its cradle. He backed around the bishop's chair and locked the office door. Then he returned to his seat behind the desk. The two men were quiet as the bishop restored his sense of superiority. "Well, head waiter Rostov, it seems that by threat of violence, you have succeeded in keeping me against my will. What do you intend to do now?"
"We're going to wait."
"Wait for what?" The Count didn't answer. After a few moments, one of the telephones began to ring. Instinctively, the bishop reached for it, but the Count shook his head. It rang 11 times before it went silent. "How long do you expect to hold me here?" insisted the bishop. "An hour? Two? Until morning?" It was a good question. The Count looked around the walls of the room for a clock, but couldn't find one. "Give me your watch," he said.
"Excuse me?
You heard me." The bishop removed the watch from his wrist and tossed it on the desk. Generally speaking, the Count was not in favor of relieving men of their possessions at gunpoint, but having prided himself on ignoring the second hand for many years, the time had come for the Count to attend to it. According to the bishop's watch, which was probably set 5 minutes fast to ensure that he was never late for work, it was almost 1 a.m. There would still be a few of the hotel's guests returning from late suppers, a few stragglers in the bar, the clearing and setting up of the piazza, the vacuuming of the lobby, but by 2:30 the hotel would be quiet in every corner.
"Make yourself comfortable," said the Count.
Then, to pass the time, he began to whistle a bit of Mozart from Così fan tutte. Somewhere in the second movement, he became conscious of the fact that the bishop was smiling dismissively.
"Is there something on your mind?" asked the Count.
The left upper corner of the bishop's mouth twitched.
"Your sort," he sneered. "How convinced you have always been of your rightness of your actions, as if God himself was so impressed that your precious manners and delightful way of putting things that he blessed you to do as you pleased. What vanity."
The bishop let out what must have passed in his household for a laugh.
"Well, you have had your time," he continued. "You have had your chance to dance with your illusions and act with impunity, but your little orchestra has stopped playing. Whatever you say or do now, whatever you think, even if it's at 2 or 3 in the morning behind a locked door, will come to light, and when it does, you will be held to account."
The Count listened to the bishop with genuine interest and a touch of surprise.
His sort? The Lord's blessing that he could do as he pleased, while dancing with his illusions?
The Count had no idea what the bishop was talking about. After all, he had now lived under house arrest in the Metropole Hotel for over half his life. He almost smiled, on the verge of making some quip about the large imaginations of small men, but his expression grew sober, as he considered the bishop's smug assurance that all would come to light. His gaze shifted to the filing cabinets, of which there were now 5. With the barrel of the pistol still trained on the bishop, the Count crossed to the filing cabinets and pulled at the left uppermost drawer. It was locked.
"Where's the key?"
"You have no business opening those cabinets. They contain my personal files." The Count went around to the back of the desk and opened the drawers. They were surprisingly empty. Where would a man like the bishop keep the key to his personal files? Why, on his person, of course. The Count came around the desk and stood over the bishop. "You can give me that key," he said, "or I can take it from you. But there is no third way." When the bishop looked up with an expression of mild indignation, he saw that the Count had raised the old pistol in the air with the clear intention of bringing it down across his face. The bishop took a small ring of keys from his pocket and threw it on the desk. Even as they landed in a jangle, the Count could see that the bishop had undergone something of a transformation. He had suddenly lost his sense of superiority, as if all along it had been secured by his possession of these keys. Picking up the ring, the Count sorted through them until he found the smallest. Then he unlocked all of the bishop's filing cabinets, one by one. In the first three cabinets, there was an orderly collection of reports on the hotel's operations, revenues, occupancy rates, staffing, maintenance, expenditures, inventories, and yes, discrepancies. But in the remainder of the cabinets, the files were dedicated to individuals, in addition to files on various guests who had stayed in the hotel over the years. In alphabetical arrangement were files on the members of the staffs, of the staff, on Arkady, Vasily, Andriy, Emil, even Marina. The Count needed no more than a glance at them to know their purpose. They were a careful accounting of human flaws, noting specific instances of tardiness, impertinence, disaffection, drunkenness, sloth, desire. One could not exactly call the contents of these files spurious or inaccurate. No doubt, all of the aforementioned had been guilty of these human frailties at one point or another. But for any of them, the Count could have compiled a file 50 times larger that catalogued their virtues. Having pulled the files of his friends and dumped them on the desk, the Count returned to the cabinets and double-checked among the R's. When he found his own file, he was pleased to discover that it was among the thickest. The Count looked at his watch, or rather the bishop's. It was 2:30 in the morning, the hour of ghosts. The Count reloaded the first pistol, tucked it through his belt, and then pointed the other at the bishop. "It's time to go," he said. Then he waved at the files on the desk with the pistol. "They're your property. You carry them." The bishop gathered them up without protest. "Where are we going?" "You'll see soon enough." The Count led the bishop through the empty offices, into an enclosed stairwell, and down two flights below street level. For all his persnickety command of the hotel's minutiae, the bishop had obviously never been in the basement. Coming through the door at the bottom of the stairs, he looked around with a mixture of fear and disgust. "First stop," said the Count, pulling open the heavy steel door that led into the boiler room. The bishop hesitated, so the Count poked him with the barrel of the gun. "Over there." Taking a handkerchief from his pocket, the Count opened the small door in the furnace. "In they go," he said. Without a word, the bishop fed the flames with his files. Perhaps it was his proximity to the furnace, or the exertion of carrying the stack of dossiers down two flights of stairs, but the bishop had begun to sweat in a manner that was distinctly out of character. "Come on," said the Count. "Next stop." Once outside the boiler room, the Count prodded the bishop down the hall to the cabinet of curiosities. "There, on the lower shelf, get that small red book." The bishop did as he was told and handed the Count the Baedeker for Finland. The Count nodded his head to indicate that they were headed farther into the basement. The bishop now looked quite pale, and after a few steps, it seemed his knees might buckle beneath him. "Just a little farther," coaxed the Count, and a moment later, they were at a bright blue door. Taking Nina's key from his pocket, the Count opened it. "In you go," he said. The bishop stepped in and turned. "What are you going to do with me?" "I'm not going to do anything with you." "Then when are you coming back?" "I'm never coming back." "You can't leave me here," said the bishop. "It could be weeks before anyone finds me." "You attend the daily meeting of the Boyarsky, Comrade Leplevsky. If you were listening at the last one, you would recall that there is a banquet on Tuesday night in the ballroom. I have no doubt that someone will find you then." At which point, the Count closed the door and locked the bishop into that room where pomp bides its time. "They should get along just famously," thought the Count. It was 3 a.m. when the Count entered the belfry on the lobby floor. As he climbed, he felt the relief of the narrow escape. Reaching in his pocket, he removed the stolen passport and the Finnish marks and tucked them in the Baedeker. But when he turned the corner on the fourth floor, a shiver ran down his spine. From the landing, just above him, was the ghost of the one-eyed cat. From his elevated position, the cat looked down upon this former person, who was standing there in his stocking feet with pistols in his belt and stolen goods in his hand. It has been said that Admiral Lord Nelson, having been blinded in one eye during the Battle of the Nile in 1798, 3 years later, during the Battle of Copenhagen, held his telescope to his dead eye when his commander raised the signal for retreat, thus continuing his attack until the Danish Navy was willing to negotiate a truce. Though this story was a favorite of the Grand Duke's and often retold to the young Count as an example of courageous perseverance in the face of impossible odds, the Count had always suspected it was a little apocryphal. After all, in the midst of armed conflicts, facts are bound to be just as susceptible to injury as ships and men, if not more so. But at the onset of the summer solstice of 1954, the one-eyed cat of the Metropole turned his blind eye upon the Count's ill-gotten gains, and without the slightest expression of disappointment, disappeared down the stairs. Whew, this is a long one. My voice is tired, but I'll see you next time for the last section. Bye.